And before you focus too much on this awesome dude here, that's me, I just want to draw attention to these three sets of concentric circles, which amongst professional stone skippers are called plinks and pity pats for some reason. And that's exactly what we're going to talk about today, why these things exist and why they work and how they work. So what exactly I'm going to tell you today, I'm going to give a little bit of a motivation and, you know, I'm going to tell you why this actually is an interesting problem to talk about, a couple of experimental results, and then we're going to analyze a simple physical model and see what we get from there, basically. Cool. Now, why is this interesting? Now, basically, hands up, who's ever tried stone skipping before? Yeah. Who's ever managed to do more than four bounces? More than five? More than six? Okay, how many did you manage? What's the record? Okay, that was mine. Right, so as you can see, loads of people have tried it. Most people haven't actually got very far. The thing is, it's actually it seems to be a surprisingly established sport, so to speak. There's even a governing body, the NASSA, stands for North American Stone Skipping Association. They kind of organize, you know, competitions, championships, world championships, European championships, whatever. And they also keep track of records, and they kind of do publicity and things. So that's a picture from one of the world championships. And although people have been doing this for quite a while, it seems surprising that the first serious physical papers on this topic actually didn't appear until 1992. Where people have actually, for the first time, actually tried to do it properly. It turns out that a lot of the ways that you would think about the problem intuitively turned out to be completely wrong, and that the actual physics is quite different and also a lot simpler. And ultimately, obviously, you want to kind of optimize the parameters, what angle to refer it at, what speed, et cetera, so that we obviously get to get as many bounces or as far of a distance as possible. Just by the way, the world record is 51 at the moment. So if you want to give it a shot, go ahead. Cool. Now, because we're all theoretical physicists, I'm going to talk a little bit about experiments. A couple of people have done, so this experiment was done in 2004, I think. And what they found was actually quite surprising. They found there are actually two angles involved here in this problem. The first one is kind of the tilt of the stone that that has while it travels along. So the tilt of the stone with respect to the horizontal, that's the angle that I'm talking about here. And there's another angle, which is kind of the angle at which the stone approaches the water surface. I'm talking about the first one, and it turns out that the optimum angle is basically 20 or just under 20 degrees. Pretty much no matter how fast how fast you throw it, how fast you spin it, or at what within a certain reason at what angle you approach a water surface. They did a couple of experiments. I've got the graphs here. I didn't really want to go into the details of them, but basically you can always see that the curves have been plotting. So these curves are against the minimum velocity. Approaching angle and the skipping time, which is time that the stone is actually in contact with the water. And they're all being optimized at around this constant angle of 20 degrees, which I think is quite surprising. We won't be able to get this this result from our very simple model, but slightly more sophisticated. They have been obtained from slightly more sophisticated models, which we unfortunately don't have time to go into more details. And there are also a couple of people who've done computer simulations on these kind of topics, and they've basically found pretty much exactly the same results. Cool. Now, the actual model is, by the way, that's a photo of the world record holder. If you want to try to break the world record, you basically first better try to look as cool as this guy. What we found a little bit surprising was when we actually did analysis which forces were relevant, but like even more important, which forces were actually not relevant. So relevant forces are obviously gravity because you know the stone is quite heavy, and the lift and the drag. But lift, I mean the reactional so the reactional force from the collision with the water surface. What I don't mean by lift is you know. The lift that you get from spinning the stone in the sense of a helicopter, so that's that turns out to be completely negligible, as we'll see later in a little bit more detail. And what is also negligible is the buoyancy, and that's roughly speaking because you always want to have really, really thin stones because they work best, and because the thin stones are really, really thick, and they don't even get completely immersed in the water, as you can see from these pictures here. The amount of displaced water is actually really, really small. So that is, if you do a rough order of magnitude calculation, that's completely negligible. And when we first started thinking about the problem, we kind of thought, you know, maybe the spin is really, really important. Maybe it works a little bit like a helicopter. Turns out it's completely wrong. And I'll leave the details to Ilya. Cool. Probably want this. Actually, I don't think you want it, but I'll give it to you anyway.
Right. Okay. All right. So I'm going to tell you guys a little bit about our simplified model for the stone-water collision, which is what we have going on here. So here we have the stone making contact with the water surface. So the stone we're going to treat as being circular with and also as being very thin, so as a with the negligible thickness, as Yemin was mentioning. So basically, it's a very thin cylinder. Let's see, I should also tell you about the relevant parameters here. So illustrated in this picture are all the parameters that are going to be needed for the analysis of this problem. So first, we have the depth here, Z. This corresponds to the depth to which the stone is submerged in the water when it makes contact. This S immersed, this corresponds to the area of the stone that is making contact with the water surface. This vector V is the velocity vector of the center of mass of the rock. The angle beta is the angle at which the stone is approaching the water relative to the horizontal. And the angle theta is the angle of inclination of the stone relative to the water surface. So we can see that as the stone makes contact with the water, there's going to be a reaction force of the water pushing back on the stone. We have it summarized right here. And we can very conveniently break this force up into two components, one being the drag force. Oh, this is actually backwards. So this should be the lift force here. I'm sorry. This lift and this drag should be switched. But so we have a lift force that acts perpendicular to the surface of the stone and a drag force which acts along the direction of the stone. Their functional form is very similar. We have these coefficients. So CL and CD, these are the coefficients of lift and drag, respectively. In general, these coefficients will depend on the angles theta and beta, so the angle of inclination and the angle of approach. But for our simplified analysis, we'll treat them as constant. S immersed, again, is the portion of the area of the stone making contact with the water surface. Rho is the density of water, and V is the magnitude of the velocity of the water. And of course, there's the gravitational force acting. That's going to be important. And as Yemin mentioned, we're going to ignore buoyancy because we assume a negligible thickness and hence a negligible amount of water displaced. Okay, great. So now, given that we know these forces, we can do a more thorough analysis of the bounce of the stone. So first, we have to make a physical assumption that we're just going to kind of put in by hand, and that is that the stone will not bounce if it becomes fully immersed in the water. So you're not going to get that out of the equations of motion. That's just something we put in by hand. Now, the second piece of information we need is the equation of motion in the z direction, which I've summarized here. So it's basically, you know, you need to consider the components of lift and drag in the vertical direction and also, of course, the gravitational force. And together, these two things, so this assumption, this equation of motion, will give you a condition on the initial velocity of the stone that is required for it to actually bounce. And it makes sense that such a condition should exist, because if the stone isn't moving fast enough, then the lift force won't be able to compensate for the stone's weight, and it'll just sink. Great. So doing a more thorough analysis, we can integrate that equation of motion that I just presented, and we get what is sort of like an effective energy and an effective potential, which I've plotted here. So this is the effective potential, and this is the constant energy of the stone. It's not really the energy because we're just looking at one of the components of the motion. But anyways, so here we have plotted the intersection also between the constant energy and the effective potential, and we see that they intersect at a point we call Z max. So this is also a turning point in the sense that the energy is equal to the effective potential at the place where dz dt vanishes, meaning the stone has stopped and it's turning back around. And so now we're going to demand that this Z max be smaller than the depth for which the stone would be fully immersed. So that was the first assumption that I mentioned on the previous slide. So putting these things together, we get a lower bound on the x component of the initial velocity. So that lower bound we call Vc, the critical velocity. And using some typical parameters, we get that this is roughly 1 meter per second. So this is the velocity you would need to send the stone in with at least the x component of the velocity in order for it to actually initially bounce off that water the first time. Okay, so I'm going to turn it over to Aisha now, and she'll tell you guys about some of the other effects that are important here.
Okay, so now we understand the physics of a single bounce, and we talked about the initial velocity right before one bounce, but what about how many bounces we can get for the entire throw? So there are two ways that the stone will stop bouncing. The first way is through dissipation along the x component of the direction of motion, because as we were, as Ilya discussed before, it's elastic collisions in the z direction, so we don't consider dissipation through that effect. But we're going to talk about the x component of the lift and drag forces that are going to dissipate the energy from the kinetic energy initially given to the stone. And then the second thing that can happen is throughout we're assuming that there's a constant angle theta and that it's relatively small. So when we talked about the initial x component of velocity, actually we assume that's most of the component of the entire velocity. But what can happen is if you have instability, the angle can vary as it hits the water. So if it just deflects off of the water and now at the next bounce you have a very large angle of incidence, you're not going to have the proper parameters for a successful bounce. So we're going to talk about, after this, I'm going to explain how spin can stop that from happening. So the first effect, this energy dissipation, in the model we have that the x component of the dissipative forces from the water reactive force is about equal in the x and z components, except for this proportionality factor. Don't worry about exactly how it's derived. And we also assume that at all times in the z component, the total force on the stone is about the order of magnitude of its weight. So basically, when it's accelerating upwards from the stone or from the water, it's about the same acceleration as when it's going downward. So we can just estimate that with mg. And so here we get the work done by the dissipative forces is about some constant mu times mgl, and l is also characterized by some parameters giving the time that it takes for the stone to go through, and that depends on some characteristic velocities and frequencies. So that means that we can require that the total work done by the dissipative force has to be less than the initial kinetic energy when we first throw the stone, in order for it to continue bouncing one more time. And that gives us another lower bound that's actually higher than the one we had originally for a successful single bounce on the initial velocity. So now we need an even higher initial velocity just to make sure we can bounce more than once. So the second thing is spin. And so initially we thought that spin might help it actually stay in the air, but what is happening instead is the spin is stabilizing the theta angle so that we make use of the gyroscopic effect. So what we can do is consider the torque caused by the lift force. So we have this stone coming in and lift is going to push it upwards, and of course there's going to be a torque and that's going to increase your angle. And so we can get the equation of motion here where I is the moment of inertia along the t direction, which you can recall is along the stone surface, whereas n is in the direction of lift perpendicular to the stone surface. And so phi dot is the initial angular velocity that is about the axis coming out of the page, the y-axis. So that's the spin that you want to give to the stone when you throw it. And if it's zero, you can see here that omega will vanish, and you're going to have acceleration of the angle of incidence, and we don't want that. So instead, we introduce an initial angular velocity phi naught, and exactly what the order of magnitude that spin has to be is determined by assuming that we want this variation, the maximum variation in angle in a single throw, to be much less than one. And we can estimate that also in terms of the parameters by assuming that the x and y components of velocity are about equal with a proportionality constant. So now we have conditions on our initial x component of velocity as well as conditions on our initial spin in order to have a stable motion that's going to successfully have enough energy to keep bouncing. And our question is for how long? So those two factors that are going to stop it from bouncing give two different maximum numbers of bounces you can get in a single throw, and you just take the minimum one depending on the bounce, or on the throw. So assuming that you could keep throwing as fast as possible, if you only considered energy dissipation, you could keep raising the maximum number of throws. So you would just require that after n bounces, the total amount of dissipated energy is less than your initial kinetic energy. And then here you get a simple bound on the maximum number of bounces. But more importantly, if at each bounce you have a maximum variation of delta theta, after n bounces, let's say you want a cumulative variation in angle of about 1 radian, then you have a stronger bound here on the maximum number of bounces. And it's usually this instability in practice that will actually stop you from getting more than 7, for example, bounces when you're trying to skip stones. So in conclusion, the model was a bit surprising with the assumptions we've made, because the things that we thought were important, like spin, were only important for stability, and things like buoyancy didn't matter because we were considering a flat stone. It might be interesting to consider a more complex model with a three-dimensional stone if we don't treat the thickness as negligible. And some more complex theories that we found in some papers actually did predict theoretically the angle of 20 degrees that Yimin discussed was also found experimentally independently. So that's another interesting direction to go if anybody's interested in researching this further. And these are our references. So.
Choose a small flat stone, right? Yeah. And I guess that everyone that has done stone skipping tries to find this type of rocks that are flat in their surface. I don't know if you are aware of any kind of study that shows which is the best geometry for the stone in order to have the greatest amount of skips.
So the analysis in this, I think it's the first paper, it does it for both a square stone and a circular stone. And in terms of order of magnitude and stuff, everything is roughly the same. There's some geometrical factors that come in. I don't know offhand which one's better. But if you take a look at that paper, you can probably see, just numerically, which one's better. But the form of the critical velocities and stuff like that is roughly the same.
All right, and the second one, you calculated the velocity for the 51 skips just to see, kind of have an idea of how hard you have to throw the.
It was referenced. It was mentioned somewhere within the calculator. I can't remember that time.
Something under 50 meters, because we're looking at the order of magnitude of 10 meters per second, right? And it was definitely. Some tens or something
so
like that.
Something that is humanly possible.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah. Also, in terms of the best shape, certainly flatness is important when we're considering we want some sort of symmetry in the moments of inertia, except for the direction that we want to spin about. So the direction that we're using the spin, we have a flat stone, so that we can have just the stability is benefited by that.
There's another question.
You're saying our model when you're discussing the simple model. Was it actually your model?
No. But interestingly, a lot of the things that we were expecting ended up showing up after some thought. So what we did is we actually decided to try to do it for 2 or 3 days, just thinking up on our own what we could do, and then we checked it against this first paper yesterday, I think. And some things were completely off, like there was no spin in the air. But I think we predicted that the spin would be stabilizing and that, yeah, and the lift.
And, I may have missed it, but did anyone consider the properties of the fluid or liquid that you're bouncing off? Things like surface tension or?
You want to describe your, since you're still.
So in this problem, we didn't consider anything about, except for the density of the fluid, we didn't really consider any effects like that. But I know, I don't remember which paper it was, but I think there has been some analysis done on, like, if you were to throw it off, like, a blanket on a table or something.
Okay.
So yeah, different, how different material properties would affect it. But yeah, we did do that analysis.
What about the coefficients, CL and CD? They also...
The drag and lift coefficients are also, they depend on the material as well.
Is it just the density of it, or
The density is rho, but C depends on like things like incidence angle and on the material and like a bunch of other properties.
Yeah, certain material properties. I don't know what comes up. Yeah.
Jason?
So I saw that like when you were trying to figure out whether this stone would keep skipping, that like there was a condition that the x velocity has to be non-zero. I'm curious, like, where the model, if you considered that, like, because often when I try to skip a stone, it just, like, splashes into the water. Like, the x velocity is fine, but it just, like, sinks. So, you know what I'm talking about? Like, is there a condition for, like, bouncing versus splashing?
Right. So, which one were you referring to? So,
W is, like, less than, like, 1/2 the x squared. That just says that, like, it has lost enough energy, so it has x velocity.
So there's three things. The first one that Ilya talked about was enough velocity so that you can actually have the collision succeed so that you don't get submersed fully, because once you're submersed fully, you would drop. So probably when you do it, you might not have a high enough velocity so that it doesn't just get submerged.
So it was that first equation.
Then. That was the first thing. These things are so that you can have enough energy to keep going, and that has to do with the dissipative forces in the x component, and it also has to do with having a stable enough variation in your angle of incidence, because that's important. We assume a constant angle of incidence that's relatively small. So, I don't know if there's any more questions.
Okay, any other questions?
I have a couple of questions. So when the stone hits the water, it's obviously in elastic collision. Do you know how much energy is lost typically in percentages after this collision?
Usually 5 bounces before it stops, right? So.
Okay, 5 bounces before it stops. But the record is 51 bounces. So any idea how this can be achieved? It's such a high number of bounces?
A lot of energy.
I know that from my own experience of trying to skip stones. I personally always find it really hard to give the stone a spin. I mean, professional stone skippers, for them it's the easy job. For them it's probably only about how fast can you actually throw it. But for me, I find it very hard to actually give it a spin. So it will eventually be really unstable. And you can also see from the fact that it not only randomly change the angle, but also if randomly change the direction, so it's kind of planting off, and so that has to do with that as well.
Would you expect this to be a non-trivial relationship between either the spin or the initial speed and the angle at which you're skipping it? Like, if I'm trying to skip a stone, should I vary the how hard I throw depending on what angle I'm throwing it?
So. That sort of like is related to that last question too, in that if you want it to have enough energy to keep going, you can just keep raising the velocity, and that's like a completely independent thing from the angular stability. Whereas you only have a certain number of radians before you're no longer in the small angle approximation and the model is unstable. And so I think the angular issue is independent, and if you do a certain number, if you don't have enough spin, then a certain number of bounces will give you too high cumulative variation, which is mine.
So I should just always throw it as hard as I can, no matter what angle.
Yeah. And the 20 degrees is independent of velocity, you said, right?
Within a range, yeah.
Within a range. Okay.
Which which angle are you talking about? The angle of the stone?
The angle at which it hits the water, yeah.
Oh, I think, well, so in this analysis, we're focusing a lot on the x component of the velocity, and all our bounds are on that component. So you definitely want to maximize the velocity. So in that sense, you would want to throw it at an angle at which, like, a large chunk of the initial velocity is in the x direction.
Yeah, but you don't throw it very this. You don't. There's not a sort of optimal strength that depends on angle.
I think that's what these plots were doing, and I think you were saying
it's
independent.
So, as I said, the thing that I found surprising was that the experimental results predicted this same angle pretty much independent of all the other parameters. So, for example, if you take this plot here, beta here is the angle at which the stone approaches the water, and each of these dots, I don't know if you can see them from back there, but each of these dots basically represent a successful experiment. So basically, the thing to take away is if you manage to get exactly this angle right, within a certain range, it doesn't matter too much just in order to get to get any skipping at all, which angle you throw it, but deviation off this angle can give you measured results pretty quickly.
Any more questions?
Any more questions?
Yeah.
So maybe when that championship takes place, are the stones standard stones? Or
sorry?
When the championship is actually done?
Oh, so that that depends on which championship. So there is one, I think an annual one in Scotland will have something like they have to be at least at least 2 inches in diameter and things like that. But they all have their own kind of set of rules depending on where you go. The experiments here are not actually done with kind of stones. They're kind of done with kind of like small metal cylinders.
Okay, let's thank the speakers again. Okay, our next group of speakers will be Jason, Lucy, and Martin.
Is the sound working?
Huh?
Is it possible to turn on the sound?
To turn on the sound?
The sound.
The title of the talk is How Does Rain Drop?
So, hello. We're talking about how does rain drop, and we are Martin, Jason, and Lucia. So, where did we get our inspiration? We were just walking down the park, and then it was cloudy, and we saw this water park in the park, and this fountain, how does rain drop? So this is the outline of our talk. First, we will talk about the raindrop formation, then something about the shape of the raindrops, and then their size. Okay, so first, we need cloud droplets in order to have raindrops. And in order to have cloud droplets, we need that the vapor pressure reaches its saturation point, which means that the pressure exerted by the vapor into the liquid or solid is a pressure where the rate of evaporation is the same as the rate of condensation. But actually, we need supersaturations. We which means that we need more molecules evaporating than condensating. And aerosols play an important role here because with them, we need less supersaturation in order to have these cloud droplets. So aerosols are just these particles of like dust, solid in the air. And the size of these cloud droplets is about 10 microns. And the raindrops are bigger, at about 1 millimeter. So we need something to increase the size of these cloud droplets. And there are two ways to do that. The first one is collision and coalescence, and the second one is the Bergeron process. Collision and coalescence refers that in the cloud, we have some wind currents that make the cloud droplets collide. And then if they stick together after the collision, that's coalescence. That's a way to have bigger cloud droplets. And the Bergeron process is as follows. Well, the name is Bergeron after a meteorologist, Swedish meteorologist, that proposed this process in the 1930s. And we need three ingredients. First, what we call freezing nuclei, which is just ice crystals that form around some solid nucleus. And supercooled water, which is liquid water whose temperature is below 0 degrees, and the vapor. So from the point of view of this super, this is when the temperature is around minus 10 or minus 20 degrees. And so from the point of view of the cloud droplet, the air is in its saturation point. But from the point of view of the ice crystal, because the saturation vapor pressure is lower than for water, liquid water, then it actually is supersaturated. So the vapor starts to sublimate into the crystal, and then the water sees less vapor, so it begins to evaporate. And then again, the vapor sublimates into the crystal. So the crystals get bigger and bigger until they can fall. And depending on the temperature of the layers that are near the ground, you'll have rain or snow or different kinds of precipitation.
Okay, so unlike many cartoonists.
Okay, does this work? So unlike many cartoonists would make you believe, the shape of a raindrop, is not a tear, which I guess takes away the sadness from rain. So to determine what the actual shape of a raindrop is, there are a few things that we need to consider in our model. First, we need to ask ourselves, how would a raindrop look if it wasn't affected by any forces, just static amount of water exposed in air? So as you see right here, it's just spherical. It's pretty simple to explain. When no forces are present, the surface of the water wants to minimize its free energy. And the way it does that is to reduce its surface area. And the shape which it assumes is a sphere. Another way to think of it is by the internal pressures in the liquid. Here we have a Young-Laplace's equation, which describes the pressure difference at the surface between two immiscible fluids. So if the raindrop would have different radii, or any other shape rather than a sphere, at different places along the surface, following this equation, you would have different radii, and therefore different internal pressures. So these this would cause a pressure gradient and would drive water to move from one area of higher pressure to an area of lower pressure. And this would once again assume the shape of a sphere. Now, what happens as it's falling? Here right above, you have the shape of different initial drop sizes. So at the center here, you have for 1 millimeter, and it goes out to 6. As you can see, it's not a tear, but more or less a hamburger bun. So how is this shape determined? The model we looked at used the incompressible Navier-Stokes equation with certain initial conditions. So here we started, the model starts with a spherical drop. We assume constant density and viscosity of the air and water. It also assumes constant gravitational acceleration, conservation of momentum at the surface, conservation of volume, and as well as zero flow velocity at the surface, so that no liquid comes in or out of the raindrop. We also assume no stress along the axis of symmetry and no shear forces. So as you can see, if the initial raindrop is small, roughly 1 millimeter or less, the shape of the raindrop stays spherical. So if you want physical intuition as to why that happens, the smaller the drop, the smaller the terminal velocity is. So as it moves through the air, the water just flows around it, and the viscosity doesn't really change the flow of the water. So it comes back up, and the pressure, there's no pressure difference from the top to the bottom because of turbulent airflows. And also, since the drop is so small, the internal pressures are high, and they counteract the effect of gravity. So gravity is negligible, and we basically have a free static drop. Now, for the bigger initial sphere, you see that the shape of the raindrop is not spherical. So here we'll just consider how the air moves around. So as the rain drops, the pressure at the bottom increases because obviously more air molecules hit the bottom. And as it flows around, it reduces the pressure on the sides. And because of because air and the air is viscous, there are vortexes that form at the top of the bubble, which lower the pressure a bit, but the pressure at the top is still higher than at the sides. So what this causes is it causes increased internal pressure at the top and the bottom, therefore you have pressure gradients in the bubble, in the water drop, which drives the water to move from the top and the bottom to the sides. So therefore the sides bulge out a bit and increase the curvature, and the bottom flattens out. If air was perfect fluid, and the pressure at the top and bottom were the same, you would have more of a flat shape. But because of those turbulent airflows at the top, the top of the raindrop does not flatten out as much as the bottom. So yeah, I guess that's how it obtains its hamburger shape.
Alrighty. So now that we have some nice hamburger buns falling through the air, there's a good question of what determines raindrop size. And so most of the research done in this field is way more numerical than like coming up with a physical model. They do some physics. But the first experiment done in it was in 1948. And what sort of shocked me was how popular raindrop experiments are, that this initial paper has over 2,400 citations, which I guess, you know, make of it whatever you want. So the thing about all these plots is that when I first saw this, I was confused by the y-axis. It's over meters to the fourth. And it's because it's like a probability density distribution or number density distribution. So the density of drops with diameter between d and d plus delta d is given by n times delta d. So that explains the units. And then the other 3 meters come from the spatial density. So what Marshall and Palmer initially found in their first study is that it follows a roughly an exponential model. And where's the hockey stick? Thanks. So it follows a roughly exponential decaying model, which isn't that surprising, right? You would expect that there's like zero drops as the drop diameter goes to infinity. And what was kind of surprising is they found that this number, the initial number of drops at zero diameter, is independent of rainfall intensity, and that the sort of shape of the exponential is dependent on rainfall intensity, with d being the highest rainfall rate. One of the things that they found in their studies is that this model didn't account for, it predicted too many drops at lower diameters than they actually found. So
where are is it that little bunch of drops on the left there?
Yeah, so like an exponential sort of should look like this, right? And instead it's like kind of curving off. Like this, these tails shouldn't really curve off.
So those lines aren't the theoretical model, that's just a bit of the data, is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, so after this, people got smarter and actually looked more in depth about how raindrops change size instead of just empirically this is how it is. And there's sort of two main ways. There's collisions and explosions. And the collisions were first parameterized by Low and List in 1982, and the explosions were characterized by Virmo and Bosa in 2009, which also shows this research is still really current. So I'm first going to talk about the collisions, and I'll talk about the explosions. So with the collisions, when raindrops collide, they can either break up or coalesce, as Lucia was talking about earlier. So this is an example where they coalesce. Hoping that would loop. So for those who missed the first time, so you see that right there, the raindrop, two raindrops collided and it made a bigger drop. So that was the first part of the of Low and List parameterization. And the new size of the drop's relatively easy to figure out because you know the new mass of the drop because they just stick together. So then the harder one is when the raindrops break up. You can see that when they break up, they kind of shatter into a whole bunch of different fragments. And so how Low and List dealt with this case is that they broke up the collisions into three categories based on the shape that the raindrop assumes right after the collision. So there's the filaments, the disks, and the sheets. This is an example of the filaments, because you can see there's kind of like some filaments coming out of the raindrop right after they collide. And for each type, they independently fit a numerical model. Like I guess they collided a whole bunch of drops together and categorized all their collisions into the three different categories. And then for each category, they did a numerical analysis, numerical parameterization of the distribution. And then they combined all three together based on the relative probabilities of the drop assuming that shape after the collision. And what they found is that they came up with this parameterization. Then later, Valdez and Young in 85 put this together with cloud drop formation, with drop formation in clouds, to come up with a model of what you would actually find if you just like stuck a piece of paper out and measured all the sizes of the drops. And as you can see, the dashed lines are the Marshall-Palmer distribution, and the solid lines is the updated distribution. And all the different lines are for different rainfall intensities. So those are the collisions. Now, what's slightly more fun is the explosions, and this was only really found in 2009. Here's a slow motion video of a raindrop actually exploding. So So as you can see, like you start with a big raindrop and you end up with all of these little drops of different shapes and sizes. And what Villamoreau and Bosta argued is that the timescale for this process is much smaller than the timescale for the collisions. So this process actually dominates what determines the raindrop size distribution. They use some fluid mechanics to actually come up with a model and try to describe it. The main point is that there's something called the Weber number, which is the ratio of inertia to surface tension. And if that number they said was higher than 6, then the raindrop would explode. And if it's smaller, then the raindrop would just sort of oscillate around a mean, like you saw in one of the first videos of the raindrop kind of like doing a jelly bean thing. They also found that this this mechanism gave a better exponential fit that Marshall and Palmer found. And so it agreed with the data. And this was from a news source, so it actually made like local news. So in conclusion, the way that clouds drop or rain drops is that cloud droplets first become raindrops by increasing size in a cloud. Once they become heavy enough, they fall, and when they fall, they look like hamburger buns, not teardrops. We clearly just focused on the water case, not the snow case. Then as they're falling, collisions and explosions produce a roughly exponential distribution of sizes. And that's it. Here are our citations, if you want to read more.
Okay. Any questions?
So you mentioned that the presence of aerosols tends to increase the formation of raindrops. Does that mean if you're in an area with a lot of pollutants, then is it more likely to rain there?
I guess so, yeah.
Something related with what Emily said. So how dependent is the size of the drop in the composition of water? I mean, water, you're assuming, or they assume, I guess, pure water, right? But actually, in real life, it's a solution of different things. So do you expect, for example, that if there is a lot of pollutants in water at the clouds, the drops would be different, or the rates of explosions or coalescence are different?
So I think that the overall shape of the distribution would be the same. But like it might, the mean, so like the average size might differ. I'm not sure exactly how it would. Because, for example, things like rainfall intensity move the mean of the distribution around. So like as you would expect, the harder the rains, the bigger the drops are and stuff like that.
Yeah. Sorry, I was just following my question. Has anyone sort of checked or observed this effect? Like, does it actually rain more in more polluted areas?
I'm sure someone has. I don't think we saw any papers.
No,
yeah.
But, I can check it.
Yeah.
No, but it's just interesting.
I mean, it has over 2,400 citations, so
someone
I'm sure.
Said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why do the raindrops self-explode?
Oh, so if you see the video, you can kind of see why. So, like, as it's falling, it sort of flattens out, and then like sort of the pressure in the middle gets high, and then just like the surface tension of the drop can't withstand the air pressure anymore, and it just breaks apart.
Is there any critical velocity for the motion of the drop before it explodes?
It didn't seem to depend on velocity as much as the Weber number, because the velocity is kind of determined by the mass,
mm-hmm.
which is sort of wrapped in the Weber number because you have the inertia over the surface tension.
Because
mm-hmm. if you have like a super high surface tension, then it wouldn't really matter, and yeah.
So,
Have you seen any, I guess, explanation or refutation for phenomena where there are, for example, large but sparse raindrops?
Yeah, sort of. Well, like sort of all the distributions like observed say that it's exponential. That I don't think anyone's really observed anything else, especially because the large raindrops, like if you saw like raindrops larger than like 4 millimeters, just like they explode anyway. So you really wouldn't find like a whole bunch of large sparse drops.
But for example, before a thunderstorm, it'll usually at least feel like there are large drops, even though they're coming pretty sparsely.
Yeah, I mean, not in any of the models that we looked at.
Not a very physics-y question, but do you have any idea where this misconception of a teardrop actually comes from? Because it's not a very, like, you know, it's not a, even if I have no physical intuition whatsoever, it's not a very intuitive thing to think about. Like, I would think of, like, I would have never thought of a teardrop unless children's cartoon videos have told me that's what it looked like.
Probably the same place the heart shape came from, you know?
I think that it's leaving a tap and it's still attached to the... That's kind of the only time you see it slowly, as it's just about to drop.
Okay.
Wait, did you say water dripping off a faucet?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you have a question?
So you were talking about the small drops not being affected by gravity. And so I'm not sure how much gravity plays compared with, you know, air resistance. And have there been any studies done with raindrops falling in a vacuum to see whether they would actually deform at all, or that they just remain the same?
I mean, there were a lot of models that we saw, and some of them didn't consider gravity, and they still ended up with the same shape. The gravity is just because, so it's going to induce like higher internal pressures at the bottom compared to the top, so it's just going to force more water from the bottom to move through the drop, but it wasn't, I don't think it was something really noticeable.
Yeah, I wouldn't have thought between one mil and six mil, it wouldn't have made
a difference. The only, most of the experiments that have been done were in wind tunnels, so they like took a lot of pictures of the raindrops and then fit their model to it.
Mm-hmm.
So with or without gravity, the differences weren't very noticeable.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I have a question. You showed the process where a drop explodes, right? Is there an opposite process where, for example, two drops merge and form a drop of a larger size?
Yeah, that's the...
Yeah, I decided to ask you because there is such a phenomena as a torrential rain, when the rain pours buckets, so...
Yeah, so in that one.
Uh-huh.
So what are the fast, like there's like little fast droplets and then there's a slow big droplet?
Like, yeah, I think those are just other drops that aren't... Because, as Martin said, these are in wind tunnels,
right.
So like they set a terminal velocity, like they know the relative terminal velocity of the drop.
So this big one's just floating there at some point.
Well, yeah, that's like where they set the, that's like what the mass they want to be stable is.
So
and then all the small ones are like, just go.
Yeah.
Line up.
Okay, what is the average speed the drops actually hit the ground?
Oh, I'm not sure. I didn't. I'm sure it's in one of the papers. I didn't
I think it was roughly 6 or 8 meters per second.
Mm-hmm. I said 6 or 8 meters per second.
Yeah. Depends on the drop size, obviously. But if you average like 4 to 5, like 3 to 4 millimeter drops, I think most of the time the numbers were 8 meters.
Any other questions or comments? Yeah.
What are some possible applications of knowing the shape or distribution of rain? I mean, curiosity is very important.
I mean, a lot of atmospheric science people are really interested by that. I think a lot because of just having the rate at which rain falls in certain places and being able to maybe understand why it's different and how the shape affects that. And also what happens when the raindrop collides with Earth, like the shape might have certain effects on the Earth and different types of rhythm.
Yeah.
And the whole process is important for like weather prediction. So if you know that like the like speed, the wind speed in a cloud, and like you'll know sort of how heavy a drop has to be before it can like finally overcome it and fall, and stuff like that.
Okay.
Do you know if it's raining, if you run faster, do you get
less wet? Yes, you do. Yep. There's a minute physics video about it. So you should run. Yeah, you get the least wet if you're standing still, but then you never make it there.
Yeah.
So if you have to move at all, the best would be just to run.
Yeah, because, well, the amount of rain that hits your head depends on how much time you spend going to your location, but the amount of rain you hit by walking through it depends on the distance you're running or you're walking. So you want to minimize the time you're exposed to rain, because as you're walking, you're gonna hit the same amount of rain. It just depends on the distance.
Right.
So if you run quickly, you're gonna get less rain on the top and just the same amount.
Okay, very good. Let's thank our speakers again. So, tell us about thermoregulation of moss nests. Chinpeng, Nicholas, and Anders.
Okay, good morning, everyone. So we'll be talking about thermoregulation in wasp nests. We just came across this wasp nest in the western part of the Waterloo Park. And it has this curious architecture that makes us wonder how air flows in and out of the wasp net. And more generally, whether they can use the airflow to regulate the temperature and how they can regulate the microclimate, especially temperature, in the nest. So we've been thinking about these things, and we've looked at some papers. And there are many reasons that thermoregulation is really important for them, for the wasps or bees, hornets. Well, they are similar anyway. So in the case of bees, they can only produce wax or honey at the temperature of 35 degrees. So, and in the case of wasps, the optimal temperature for the growth of the larva is from 82 to 31 degrees. And they always try to maintain the temperature at that level because the development of the colony largely depends on the development of the larva, and which are very sensitive to temperature. And in some studies show that in certain species, they even found that the workers will be employed in thermoregulation at the expense of feeding the larva, so which suggests that the temperature is really important. So basically, there are the methods for thermoregulation can be roughly classified into two types. The first, the active thermoregulation and the passive thermoregulation. Example of active thermoregulation includes they will intentionally beat their wings to create some airflow to cool down the nest. Or they might be beating their wings not to create airflow, but just to intentionally raising their body temperature to heat up the nest. Sometimes they'll even bring water drops for it to evaporate to cool down the nest, or they might just cluster together to make it warmer. Passive thermoregulation is the part we will be focusing about. So basically, that's just they'll build some fantastic architecture that can create some convective airflow to cool down the nest. So this is what we'll be talking about in the main part. First, the wasps need to determine what is the optimal temperature, and then we'll present the Philobia Spinifex Richard Hive model and Landstrom Beehive model. These two models are from research paper. And then using elements from these two models will give a qualitative approach to the beehive model we found in the Waterloo Park. So how do wasps
detect the temperature. Of course, we might think that probably they can feel temperature the same way as we do. But it seems that they have a better way of more accurate method to determine what is the optimal temperature. There were two studies that showed that, well, the first study shows that this is the electric resistivity of the WASP fluid flow, and shows that it reaches the minimum at 31 degrees Celsius, which is the optimal temperature for the WASP net. And there's another study that shows that this is the thermoelectric current of the sealed cap of the lava. This reached the maximum also at the optimal temperature for the lava. So maybe this is, so these two papers suggest that maybe they're using the electric property of themselves to determine what is the optimal temperature, so that they will know how to regulate the temperature within the nest.
So this is a little bit difficult, but okay. Well, I guess I'll talk like this. Now, as Chenfeng told us before, WASPs have this ability to determine which is the optimal temperature for their nest and for their activities. So what I'm going to try to explain a little bit is two different models that try to explain how this passive thermoregulation works. The first model is the one that was proposed by Hotsuma and his collaborators in his paper, and it's called the Polybius pinnifex Richards hive model, where essentially Polybius pinnifex is the species taxonomic classification, and the nest we can see it here. It's almost spherically symmetric, and what is important from this one is the fact that it has this slit-like entrance. So this will be kind of the theoretical model to explain. What is it about? So the physics behind this is, as Martin already introduced to us in his talk before, it's related to the Navier-Stokes equation in a particular case, in which we are considering the fluid to be some incompressible and non-viscous fluid. In this case, an ideal fluid, where we have this basically three relations or three conservation laws, which are the mass equation, the energy equation, and the momentum equation. In this case, rho stands for the density of the fluid, u stands for the velocity of the fluid, and E and P are the energy and the pressure, respectively. So if we combine these three equations, we arrive to the Navier-Stokes equation, which, with suitable boundary conditions, can be solved. Now, in this case, they propose to put some inflow-outflow boundary condition, which says that the normal component of the velocity at the boundary is zero. So, moreover, we have to have into account in this model the environmental conditions in which the nest is certainly immersed. And in this case, we're going to consider the possible airflow with a velocity of 0 to 3 meters per second at some definite temperature entering into the hive, and some heat radiation that comes from the sun. Here, the points P1 to P8 correspond to measuring points where experimental data was acquired. And E corresponds to the point on the entrance, which is here in the right part of the picture. So what they do, these are essentially the setup for what it's called the computational fluid dynamics. And it's essentially a numerical way to solve the Navier-Stokes equation. The results are presented here. These are part of the results. Essentially, what we see here is a cross-section of the hive. Look at it in the ZX plane. And B, C, and D are the other are the X set cross section. This will be the Y set cross section, and this will be the X Y cross section. So what this shows us is essentially the following: the white arrows showed us the flow of air inside of the hive or the nest, and we see that the different colors or the different profiles that we see here correspond to different velocities inside of the hive. Now, These are done for a fixed value of the entrance length, And here we see the dependence of the airflow with the length of the entrance. So what this suggests is essentially that with a bigger entrance, we have a better ventilation system. And as well, I'm going to show in the next slide, this ventilation system accounts for the thermal regulation inside of the hive. In particular, we will see that in this portion of the nest, we will have less temperature than in this portion of the nest. And here we will have even less temperature than in here, which can be seen from the following graphs. So the black data corresponds to what it's measured experimentally, and the white data corresponds what they call to the VTM, which is the virtual three-dimensional model. These are the predictions, and they're quite accurate with the what it's measured experimentally. And as I told you, remember that P4, and P8 are measuring points inside of the nest. P1 is the one that it's in the upper part of the nest, and P8 is the one that is in the lower part of the nest. And E is the entrance. So we can see that the temperature here, it's smaller than the temperature in all other points, which suggests that the ventilation due to the incoming air works pretty well. And this, the fact that in the upper part of the nest, there is even higher temperatures suggests that there is some convective flow of air going on. So this model, what is important about this model is that it considers somehow the external conditions of the hive. However, it makes another simplification as to the fact that the hive, the inside of the hive is nearly empty. Now, to consider another model that we think is more accurate is the one that is called the Langstroth beehive model, and it was proposed by Sudarsan and his collaborators at the University of Guelph. And a Langstroth beehive is essentially this beehive. It's the one that people use to collect honeybee. And we are choosing to use this model as well because the architecture of beehives is somehow similar to the architecture of wasp nests or hornet nests. So what they assume here is the following. First, we will consider that the inside of the nest works as a porous material, in which we have some solid phase, which is represented by the bees, and some fluid phase, which is represented by the air. We will also consider the fact that the beehive is isolated from the environment, right? Which allows us to find steady solutions for the Navier-Stokes equation. Moreover, we're going to consider also that the metabolic activity of the bees is quite important, right? It's pretty important. And the other simplification that it's done is that the fluid will be in its laminar regime. So the before mentioned equations that I presented to you in the simple case are modified in this way. Here there is no longer, it's this sort of conservation of mass equation, but SM corresponds to a source term that is basically accounts for the mass produced by the metabolic activity of the bees, right? It's basically depends on how much CO2 it's given into the environment by their metabolic activity. The momentum equation, however, is modified with some stress tensor due to the viscosity of the fluid and some source term, which is given here, and it has two important parameters, which are K and C2. K is the permeability of the material, while C2 is the resistance of the material to airflow. Both of them depend on what it's called the porosity, which is phi, right? And the energy equation, after a little bit of manipulation and some considerations, can be brought into this way, so that we have an equation for the temperature, right, of the air flowing into the hive or through the hive. There's another term that it's interesting here, which is QB. It accounts for the heat produced by the bees in its metabolic activity. And with the suitable boundary conditions they choose, which are the non-slip condition, that it's taking zero the velocity at the boundary of the nest, and the Dirichlet condition for the temperature, they arrive to some numerical solutions using computational fluid dynamics. And what this shows is how does air flow inside of the hive, right, or inside of the nest. And here, this is a temperature scale that it's in Kelvin. And what we see is something that is pretty suggestive, and it's this convective flow of air. So that we have here the cooler air goes down, and it begins to heat and goes into the upper part of the hive. If we combine this with the the before mentioned model of the Polybius spinifex Richards WASP, this will give us some kind of intuition of how does the Waterloo WASP nest actually might work, or how does the thermal regulation is accomplished in the nest we saw in the park. So Nicholas is going to tell us about what we suggest for this.
Lapel. All right. So now that we've talked a bit about some models and analysis that people have done before us, we'd like to actually take a look at the nest that we saw. This we believe to be American bald-faced hornet nest. And so, well, first off, this is a lot more spherical than the Langstroth beehive. It's a bit less spherical, perhaps, than the Richards wasp nest, but it's pretty round. This maybe exaggerates the hookedness a bit. It's hard to see from here, but there's a little circular opening, maybe, I don't know, 3 or 4 centimeters in diameter. And there are also these folds. Now, we took quite a while looking at those folds, and we never actually saw any wasps going in or out of them. We saw some entering them and staying for a while, perhaps, but we never could tell for certain if any of them went in to the nest from there or came out, and it seemed like they were just always hanging inside the fold and coming out. So we don't quite know the purpose. Is it just that it's convenient to leave these open as opposed to, well, obviously flaps facing up would collect rain and compromise structural integrity, or are they actually vents that help to assist in airflow, for example, by a mechanism like this? So we want to combine elements such as this into a sort of qualitative proposal for what a model of this nest might include. And obviously, we figured that doing an actual computational fluid dynamics model would be hard, and figuring out the actual, going inside to figure out the actual parameters in this nest in Waterloo Park might be discouraged by PI, but we're just going to go over what we think might happen. So this is the outside. As for what's inside, well, there's an interesting picture that I found once on Google Images and wasn't able to find again, where there's a wasp nest built on top of glass. So they actually have the interior on this glass, and a cross section is visible, and it looks like you have layers like this going all the way in. But that's not actually what we were able to find in most of the cut apart nests that we saw online, or in at least diagrams that we were able to find without paying money to read the articles. That was more like this. So this, I think, would probably be more of a yellow jacket nest. For example, you've got these pits over here that seem more indicative of that. But the structure, this internal structure here is more representative. You have this column, a large column that attaches, for example, to a branch, as in the one that we were looking at. And it goes through the top of the nest onto a top tier, and from there, various tiers of nests are connected by supports. And, well, if you've got a hole right beneath all of this, you might, for example, expect the air to flow outside on one angle and then curve and flow below. But with the nest, with that entrance to the side, you might expect something a bit different. So for example, I might expect without any vents present, without any airflow into and out of the nest, except at this entrance, I might expect first cooler air to flow up, and then as it warms up, for example, to go down, depending on how, on various parameters, for example, you might expect that from convective considerations, for it to be the other way around, that is the cooler air flows this way and then the warmer air flows this way, but on the other hand, since the since this portal is further down, you might expect this configuration. And then when you actually have the vents, it becomes very different. You'd have just air flowing in across and then being able to leave on that same side, thus meaning a shorter path for air, which means that it has less time to heat up, and so it probably gives better ventilation. So we might expect, just from ventilation considerations, that these vents would be slightly open. So those are some structural considerations for the model, internal and external. Other considerations involve insulation, which is not to be confused with insulation. Insulation is how the nest is heated up by light and solar radiation hitting it. Insulation, obviously, is what negates the effects of this. So that is one heat source. Another is, as Tianfeng mentioned, metabolic activity. Just as in you'd expect a small room with a lot of people to heat up very quickly, you've got a nest, maybe, I don't know, a couple liters. This isn't that small, I guess. But you've got a nest, maybe a couple liters, with over 100 wasps inside of that. That might cause a problem. You also have the different means of cooling. How much cooling is achieved just by convective airflow, and how much is achieved by evaporative cooling? You might expect that the inside wasp nest is going to be maybe have less fluid and fewer pores than a beehive where you have collection of honey. But on the other hand, wasps in particularly hot times might introduce water into their nest just in order to cool it down through evaporative cooling. And finally, you have the forces of convection, which are, well, first off, there's just passive heat convection, which actually, I believe the Richards paper suggests, is only a small source of the airflow inside of the nest. But the two main sources are, well, wasps beating their wings, and wind going into that portal. The wind obviously not being something that the wasps have very much control over, but wasps are expected to, in different environmental conditions based on the temperature that they sense, to beat their wings differently, different amounts. And there's also the question of how do they position themselves around the nest. For example, you have up here, you expect that the airflow is going in different directions on different sides of the portal. And here you have, well, maybe wasps would position themselves around these vents to assist in this directional airflow. Perhaps that is a reason that we saw wasps entering those vents, even if they might not have openings large enough to go inside the nest. So some questions that these raise is, obviously, what's actually going on inside those nests? What are the what kinds of fluids is present? How do the wasps intentionally try to divert airflow? Just what's the internal structure, and what kind of airflow does that lead to? A second one is, well, we have very different considerations from the Richards wasp nest model and the Langstroth beehive model. What happens if you introduce, for example, the porousness of the Langstroth model to considerations of the Richards model, for, such as the insulation, the solar, the heating from solar radiation? And perhaps most importantly and most interestingly, how does this environment and this necessity of cooling affect how wasps build their nests and how they act inside of them? For example, you don't you probably don't need that much convection and convective cooling and thermoregulation much of the year this close to the Arctic Circle. But if you were maybe a few hundred kilometers further south, would you see, for example, that those vents that we saw would be more frequent or more open? Maybe they're entirely closed on these nests, but in other nests, the wasps keep them open. And perhaps they seal them over the course of the season, or maybe over the course of a day as it cools down, and then open them up as it heats up. And how do wasps position themselves in order to beat their wings inside of these nests? And how much do they change this this activity to compensate for the differences in heat? And here are a few references that we used.
We have some time for questions.
You had this experimental data from the first model,
yep.
And you had the temperature at the top was like 40 degrees, as I remember. And you said that this was due to some convective currents or something, but you also had the temperature on the top. So you also had the temperature on the top being 40 degrees from the sun. Why did you say that that was due to the...
Well, that's one of the suggestions they have. You're right, as for example, the heat radiation that they consider is about 42 degrees, as I remember. Probably will be, the main part will be for essentially the kind of boundary condition they imposed. But as well, there might be a contribution on the fact that warmer goes upstairs in the hive, right? So probably it's not the only reason, but that's what the guys suggested in the model. And that's what gave us our idea to try to see these convective flows in the actual nest.
So you when you started considering the wasp metabolism, it looked like you added in a term to this mass equation, which you explained as the carbon dioxide production.
Yep.
Can you explain kind of what you meant by that? Because I would expect that, I mean, they're also taking in oxygen.
Right, but the fact is that bees or their metabolic activity relies on glucose combustion, right? So if there's only one bee, their metabolic activity is negligible, right? But these wasps or this nest has a lot of bees or a lot of individuals where the CO2 production might exceed the oxygen combustion, right? If they don't have the right right ventilation, they will take up all of the oxygen and the air will fill up with carbon dioxide, right? So in this case, this source term in the mass equation might be small, but you have to consider it, right? Probably there's another thing I didn't say for the sake of time, but it's the fact that the air considering here, it's a mixture of several things, right? So, and in which CO2 and O2 are the basic components.
Okay. So you would also consider an oxygen
right.
sink.
Okay. Right.
So concerning this metabolism thing, metabolism adds some kind of a source term, right?
Yeah. Right.
The equation. So it's a source.
Right.
And is it a source for energy, for mass? or for something else? So should it be added, for example, to the Navier-Stokes equation or to the, say, continuity equation for the Maslow?
So we expect, we would expect that metabolic activity, one, would affect the Navier-Stokes equation from the mass term. But the for our considerations, well, that is important because the wasps obviously don't want to suffocate. That's one of the main reasons that they do carry out this ventilation. But another thing is that they are acting as a source which would affect the convective heat flow equation, which I don't know if we included that. But they act as a most... that activity acts perhaps most importantly as a source of heat inside it.
I want to add it to it. For example, the combustion of glucose, right? It involves energy and both mass production. So what they consider in the model is essentially there is heat and mass transfer from the metabolic activity of the bees into the fluid itself, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, Emily.
Do you know anything about how much the wasp, the nest building behavior changes between different variants of wasps and to what degree that's a function of the environment?
For example, the Richards wasp nest, those spherical nests with the slit, for starters, those are built out of mud, which is actually not as good at insulating the nests, despite the fact that this is in a tropical environment where you might consider that that's more important. However, in this case, one of the primary reasons seems to be to protect it from the elements such as heavy rainfall, which might easily destroy a paper nest such as we have across the park.
I may be mistaken, but aren't wasps cold-blooded? In which case, how do they heat up by clustering?
By their metabolic activity, yeah. What Chanping said before, that they beat their wings, right?
Then they do that to cool down, right?
There's two ways. Yeah.
Right, when they're cooling down, I think they'll beat at near the entrance, so that can bring a greater amount of airflow. But when they're trying to heat up, they'll do it inside their cell. So there are heaters working specifically for just for heating up, especially in the winter. I think that's for bees. They'll stay in their like their quarters to the several points within the nest in that way to heat it up. I'm not sure about the cold blood thing, but that's what the paper, that's what the study says.
Basically, I would imagine that the cold-bloodedness of the wasps wouldn't mean that an individual wasp would be much worse at regulating its own temperature, but the wasps are still going to be producing heat on their own, even if that isn't quite enough to keep themselves warm.
I guess I have a couple questions. Did the models consider like inflow and outflow of bees, or was the number of bees or wasps kept constant inside the beehive?
They considered there is a constant amount of bees inside of the
okay.
hive.
And you were talking about like the optimal temperature for bees, like the larva growing. You said like 31 degrees.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea like what body temperature of a bee is compared to that?
Might be. I'm not quite sure, but I think I read that it's a bit colder than that.
What we have is they made some sort of estimation of how much heat does a bee produce in 10 minutes by just beating its wings. It's about a calorie, more or less,
okay.
Right? As the temperature, I agree with Champion, it's a little bit lower than the optimum.
Okay, Jeffrey, yeah, probably one last question.
So in the model with the porous media, I assume there's some kind of honeycomb structure. Do you know if there are ordered paths through that, or if there's some kind of random wall slanting?
Well, the architecture of the nest suggests that there are ordered paths, right? That's how
their social activity is organized. In the model itself, they don't consider paths, but they consider just like suppose you have different plates, right? Like in here, in this one, right? And consider this honeycomb structure to be hollow, a little bit hollow, so that air can pass through it. So what they mean by the solid phase, or what is the porous media itself, is both the bees and the structure of the hive.
Okay, let's thank the speakers again.